at the gate it is begun. All will to that coming bend. In their life, in our lives, it's a mother's yet to be. All believe the end times here by the same prophecy. By what visions, ancient tones, fading of our days, come the iron feet crumbling home from Armageddon's base. The sky will fall, impending doom, to justify all fears. Tomorrow holds a fiery tomb, but in a million years. Silver, bronze, iron and clay, a body made of these. A line of kings that come this way, or tale for Maccabees.
Just goes on and on. Anyway, I just heard from Jeff. They are now setting up for the actual roundtable discussion, which we will be broadcasting live here in just a couple minutes. So, like I said, they are setting up now, so we should be getting started in the next couple minutes. And until then, we'll get back to the music.
Follow me, the way is clear. In the wood, in the
sharper bud again. The new fruit of life within renewing. When the separation ends, will the honest make amends? The reunion of old friends ensuing.
Interesting quotes. I want to introduce our panel briefly. I want to ask them briefly to give us what they thought about what this is all about. And I've got a million questions, and I'm sure there's a million different answers that we can give. Our panel today, starting from my left, is David Chesky, Senior Vice President of Research for Jupiter Research. Stephen J. Henry, the chair of the IP Transaction Group for the law firm Wolf, Greenfield, and Sachs. Jeff Gerhardt, host and producer of The Linux Show, and Chris Sontag, of Senior Vice President and General Manager of SCO Source.
Let me hear these guys talk.
David,
for a minute.
You start. What do you think about what you heard, and what should we be looking for, and what should we be worrying about and thinking about? I don't know.
It's all right. Just
yeah.
Talk.
Okay. Yeah, it was a great presentation. I think it's really solid point. It's kind of chilling in a way because it's really a solid case for the intellectual property that that the company possesses. I think toward the end of the presentation, he tends to wrap this whole suit in the flag as preserving American jobs, standing up for intellectual property rights, and that's obviously beside the point. It's really about the self-interest of the company. I think it all boiled down to the sort of confused patrimony of the Unix source code, and the tree metaphor is a valid one for explaining what the roots of the case really are.
Steven, what do you think?
Well, I am an IP lawyer, and I believe the system works, or is supposed to work, the way Daryl explained. I believe it does protect value. It does produce incentives to innovate and invest. But there's an old expression that I think comes to mind, and that is, the devil's in the details. I was not persuaded by Daryl's speech about SCO's position, but I really don't know. In that network of something like 140 agreements they have to make their way back to AT&T, what their rights really are, and how the code base really breaks down at this point.
Mm-hmm. That's some number of like millions of lines allegedly that are
millions
present.
And millions. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, certainly as part of a community that is advocating open source, we feel very strongly about our own intellectual property and the defense of that open source intellectual property. And so really a lot of things that Daryl said today, on an intellectual basis, I'd have to agree with him. He has every right, the company SCO has every right in the world to defend their intellectual property, but a time comes when they really do have to prove their case. And up to this point, the track record of the hyperbole has been very thin, and as of yet, we have not seen within the Linux Committee 1 ounce of evidence that we've been able to duplicate that SCO has claimed.
Good.
Well, the first point I'd like to make is that, SCO's issues are not about the concept of open source. I think you heard Daryl when he spoke mentioned that, the ability for people to be able to share source code for which they have developed, or the IP basis is well understood, and is something that is reasonable, for which SCO has even participated in. Our issue is with a open source model being used to effectively hijack some of SCO's intellectual property and apply it into a
distribution model for which is very damaging to SCO and its business. We have shown source code. We have shown examples of our intellectual property violations. We've talked about the derivative works over a million lines of code that IBM and Sequent and others have contributed into Linux that has been identified, and we don't hear much about that. We have also shown some of the examples of literal copyright infringement, and those examples have been either ignored or quickly removed and said, oh, there is no more problem. The analogy I like to use in terms of, oh, just show us the code and we'll go ahead and remove it and there'll be no more problem, is the example of a bank robber who robs a bank and is, in, you know, now has the posse in hot pursuit behind him, makes a swing back around past the bank and throws the money bags back into the bank and then says, hey, no harm, no foul. There is a problem. There has been damage. Has been damage occurred. And we intend to get justice.
I have a question. The issue is that that in Linux, there are lines and lines of the original Unix code that is owned by SCO. How can Linux work if it's not based on Unix? I mean, how could you make a Linux that works if you didn't take, not, maybe not code, but maybe certainly intellectual property from that? What is Linux except a clone of Unix?
It's in no way a clone of Unix at all. In terms of our historical background, certainly the Linux community owes a historical background to Unix because the early Unix developers really developed an art form, a standardized way of developing code that is being used today by the modern IT development community, not just Linux, but across the industry. And so there is that existing art form. There are those standards that are out there. But is Linux a derivative copy of Unix? No, not, that's nonsense. It's not at all.
Absent finding a bunch of lines of code that are in the old system and in the new system, maybe Stephen, you can talk about this. If you make something that works just like something else, did you just steal something?
Well, there are two separate issues, and I think Daryl correctly tried to separate them here. Firstly, when they filed the suit, there was no copyright claim involved. It's a straight misappropriation of trade secrets and breach of contract case.
Mm-hmm.
You can read the complaint. It's online. When it comes to the copyright side, I mean, now we have questions of, was protected code copied? Ordinarily, you don't prove copyright infringement. You don't get the opportunity to prove it by having direct evidence of copying. You prove it by the fact that the accused party had access to the source code and that the result is substantially similar to the protected source code.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly sounds like, from the things that we're hearing out of SCO, that it's substantially similar, if not identical, and their burden is going to be to go back and show that those similarities are not due merely to functionality,
mm-hmm.
but they're due to the fact that somebody saw or had in mind at the time the protected copyrighted code when they wrote the Linux code.
Mm-hmm. So that you have to show that somebody did it, that there was an opportunity for somebody to do it, and then progressively they did it, rather than it's just the same because that's the way you'd need to write code.
Yeah, that is likely to be the same kind of proof, that, or more or less the same kind of proof that they'd have on the contract side to show that they didn't just have somebody who independently, without looking at the code that was under wraps, write new code that was the same.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Let me go ahead and make a comment on that because I think Steve brings up an interesting point, which is you're speaking actually to the, you know, more of the non-literal kind of versions of copyright infringement where it's not the direct line by lines, which is the majority of the copyright cases that actually go to trial end up being these very esoteric, you know, well, was the methods and the concepts and the structures and the sequence of this body of copyrighted work used. We have a substantial body of those non-literals which we have evidence and will present appropriately in court. But we also have literal copyright infringements, where the line-by-line code was copied. And we know specifically which version was copied. And the licensee from SCO, who had licensed that particular version, it all matches up, the fact points are all there. It's not some old, ancient version of Unix. It was a particular, significantly newer version of Unix that was copied. We can tell because of, you know, kind of the DNA analysis of, you know, how each version changes over time. And so just want to give that flavor that there is, you know, a strong basis for the position that we have taken.
Mm-hmm.
And we look forward to laying that all out. But we're not going to lay out the whole case for the media or before, you know, we have a respect for the law, and we're going to appropriately lay that out.
I'm a little bit surprised to see you're not going to lay it out for the media, because you seem to have been battling this case in the media quite a bit. But there's also some subtleties about copyright and intellectual property. Let's just take a case in point of one of your licensees, Sequent, as a case point. Yes, indeed, if there was a derivative work developed by Sequent, and there are derivative works developed by Sequent, you do, in fact, own copyright to the source code. But you do not own intellectual property to the trade secrets and methods by which they developed that software. And so if then the people from Sequent come along and develop very similar code, it's their right to, because they own those trade secrets and they own those methods. And so there's going to be a lot of these situations for you that are going to be next to impossible to prove out. I've got to be honest with you. The Open Source Software Initiative sat down and they did a many month-long detailed analysis comparing the various Linux kernels to System 5. And other than basic noise from the standards of which software is developed, and an awful lot of pre-existing open source code, such as the BSD code that you and I have talked about before, there is not a whole heck of a lot that we have found in a complete multi-month-long analysis. I'd like to talk to the people. You don't have to show me the code. Just let me talk to the people who did your analysis so we can compare notes. Maybe we're wrong.
This is why they have laws and lawsuits, lawyers,
right?
And lawsuits. Yeah. David, you had a question.
Yeah, I had a question for Chris. In the cases that you were just describing, crystal clear examples of copying lines of code, what motive can you imagine there be being for legitimate companies to engage in those practices when you know the infringement would be so clear cut?
You know, we don't know what the motivation was. It could have been accidental, a process by which, you know, several developers worked on something, they were testing something and didn't realize that code got into a production stream. But the copyright notices were removed and it was inappropriate. We even have leaders in the Linux community that have, you know, basically agreed that yes, that code should have not, you know, the development process was flawed by that particular vendor, and that code should have not been included, and that all future versions of Linux will have that code pulled out. So in terms of, you know, showing the code, yeah, we've shown an example, and the Linux community is trying to pull it out, but that doesn't completely solve the problem. We have many other examples that have to be rectified as well, some of which I think are substantial. Derivative works, we can argue about when a derivative work is a completely substantially different body of work. We also have a huge amount of case law regarding what is derivative works in lots of different areas and trades. But, you know, copyrighted works, the derivatives of those copyrighted works, when they're using the methods and concepts of that original work, there is afforded protection by copyright.
Chris, I want to raise our eyes up a little bit here. What we've been talking a lot about is a specific lawsuit, a specific case, and you want your money that you say was lost because this happened, and the other guys say it didn't happen, and it all goes to court, and some lawyer and some, God help us, judge decides which is right in this case. And at the end of the day, there's either you get paid some settlement money or you charge everybody for the rights and so on. Okay, fine. I never watch court TV because listening to the discussions about how a trial is going to go drive me nuts. But
here I'm, in business. I'm an enterprise IT guy. I'm trying to figure out what the heck to do in this area. Of course, I can say, oh, my God, Linux is too complicated or too risky. I have to go someplace else. Short of that, when you come a-calling someday, assuming that you win your case, what are you going to want from me? What's it going to cost me to use the Linux that I've already got sitting inside?
Simply, we want to come up with a fair and reasonable licensing policy
right. For
the appropriate IP that is,
still
IP that's in any product. And we've done lots of licensing over the years. Lots of people have licensed our intellectual property, including IBM, including HP, including Sun, and many others.
Mm-hmm.
And we just want to get reasonable licensing for that effort.
And what's your regular retail price for the regular retail products today cost? What does it cost to
anywhere
get a
from $800 to several thousand dollars
for BIM multi-user
different versions of our Unix operating system?
Okay, so I hate to say it this way, but worst case, I'm going to have to pay you some money.
Certainly, sure.
Okay, best case. Okay. It all goes to hell, or my HP, for example, indemnifies me against having to pay this extra money. I mean, when we get to a court case, what you're really just talking about is money at some place. You're saying, all right, it'll cost me this much running my multi-billion-dollar data center to make this problem go away when it becomes a problem for me.
And if I'm an IT shop
right. And
I want to have a solid basis for the technologies and, that I'm running in my organization, I think ultimately companies want to pay for the IT, for the IP that they're using in their company. Every company that I've talked to when I've sat down with them have said, we want to pay for, we want to make sure we are doing things correctly. I don't know of any chief technology officer or CIO that doesn't want to be right with the law.
Got a microphone coming up here. Okay, so that's part one of this discussion, that whatever happens here is just money. Here's Amy. Turn on the mic for Amy.
Testing.
There you go. Oh, he says it's a nicely testing.
So, first of all, several folks have gone out and surveyed the large IT shops about whether they're concerned about this issue, and 85% of them have come back and said it isn't an issue. That is, they have not stopped installing Linux, and they haven't signed up for licenses. So I would suggest to you they're a lot less concerned about this than you might imagine. Second of all, as I understand this, having spoken to several of the lawyers directly involved in the case, if you have a license already from a company that you bought Linux software from, you have in fact bought a license. And SCO can try to say anything they like, but they're going to have a lot of fun trying to get you to litigate and be forced to sign another license for something that you already own a license to. The GPL is, in fact, a license.
It's interesting.
It is an intellectual property protection in spite of what Darrell thinks.
Okay. I want to take us to the next step of this. So it's interesting. It's an interesting figure. 85% say it's not a problem because they've got money and lawyers. And if we draw the rough parallel between SCO coming after people for infringing its intellectual property and the RIAA, music people, coming after people. When they sue 12-year-old Brianna O'Hara and take $2,000 from them, that can make a lot of people in that area, in that world, scary when it's a $60 million company comes and tries to sue General Motors because of a license. It just becomes a lawsuit and it just becomes a question of dollars and cents. That's, at one level, that's I think a reasonably understandable problem. But I want to knock it up a notch because I want to say, okay, suppose I'm running Linux. Suppose I wait to see whatever's going to happen on this thing. But I'm building products on top of Linux. I'm building software on top of Linux. I'm building Linux-based products. What do I, in the way things work today, am I creating products, am I creating new problems for myself after this first problem by not building something on top of an open source product that has, what's going to happen is all of my new product that I create from down on, from here on in, is that going to get stuck with this same problem or not? Stephen, you were, Jared.
It depends upon the tools that you use to develop
mm-hmm.
technology
mm-hmm.
and the license you use to license the product.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty
mm-hmm.
of open source GPL products out there that are also available with commercial licenses.
Mm-hmm.
Apache as one. MySQL, tremendously successful company that has the same software available in two different licenses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a software development company, sure, you can develop commercial software based upon the Linux operating system. You just have to be aware of the tools that you're using and not use GPL tools.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at the way you're manipulating the operating system. And if you do modify the operating system to run the software, then, yeah, you do have certain licensing issues that you have to address.
But you're asking, if you build an application on top of unmodified operating system, are you enhancing your liability?
Right. I'm asking, where does my liability start in this next step?
Yeah, well, the problem is that this suit has injected a massive and unwelcome dose of fear, uncertainty, and doubt in an already embattled sort of IT environment. And to
right.
the extent that you have that you're using Unix of any flavor, you now have a giant headache. And to the extent that you're building applications that run on it, those, while they may not infringe, they increase your dependence on this, you know, shaky foundation that has just been shaken up.
And so what should I do to protect myself?
You've got a basic problem here. And the question a couple minutes ago highlights it. And it underlies everything that Daryl said, and that is, and I'll spare you the Latin, but the basic
the Latin
premise of the law is you can't give what you don't own. I mean, a license is not worth the paper it's written on if the licensor doesn't have the rights to give you. I mean, it's just like, you know, going out and buying a house. You better, you know, check the title.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem in the open source world is that developers have been extremely lax in worrying about title. In the simplest case, if you have a small company and it's got some stringers who do a little bit of code here and there, I mean, they don't even have written agreements to assign the rights into the company. So they give an open source license, GPL or otherwise, to what? I mean, to what they have, but, you know, that consultant or stringer can come along any time and say, wait a second, you know, you, Mr. Licensee, are now an infringer.
So we need a much more explicit understanding of who owns what in our development process.
And that's probably a limitation that exists with the... I mean, that is a very big problem with the development process in Linux right now, is that there isn't good checks and balances.
Well,
that are...
I would disagree with that. I would completely disagree with that. There is a tremendous amount of peer review that goes on within the open source marketplace that is extremely detailed, and I would venture a guess that Microsoft and SCO, not the present SCO, but the historical SCO, have been guilty of far more code obfuscation than the open source community has been.
But you can't prove it because nobody tracked it.
Oh, we certainly can because they both signed the BSD license.
Right, but I think Stephen's point is that it's not...
What is your point about...
My point is that there is peer review, that there are checks and balances. Do checks and balances need to be improved? They always do. Review always needs to be done as well as it possibly can, because everybody needs to protect everybody else's IP.
All right. Well, unfortunately,
okay?
I think there's a... it's kind of the fox guarding the hen house, because many of the core people that are involved in that peer review of the IP going into Linux have a very high degree of disdain for IP in general. There's emails that have gone back and forth by many of the principals involved with Linux talking about their disdain for patents and the that whole process, and that they ignore it. I mean, that's a documented fact that's out there. So we may have peer review, but it may not be a very effective peer review, because, like I said, it's like the fox guarding the hen house.
Well, and the more important point is that you need to prove the provenance of software that you're hoping to protect. You need
right.
to show
exactly.
with an audit trail and the right sign-offs up and down the line that this that I'm giving you, I own to give you.
And in fact, my understanding is that a lot of the contributors to Linux, you know, have Unix employment in their background.
Mm-hmm.
With companies that were under these various restrictive licenses, and where they gained access to the source code, and even if they didn't have it on paper in front of them when they were sitting down to do their Linux coding. And there may be infringements there, too, but that doesn't mean that Linux doesn't infringe.
Interesting. Got a question back here.
So going back historically, you know, let's roll the camera back, right? This, even before SCO got a hold of System 5, the issue around System 5 code being in open source is historical. And what I point back to is, you know, BSD, for instance, was basically in violation. And then he came out with BSD Lite. So 4.4 BSD came out of the university and, in fact, was stripped of all of the System 5 thing. That was settled and it was done. And I'd like to hear, Jeff.
I'd actually give you one correction. Not all of the System 5 code was stripped out. There was a certain amount of code that joint copyright attributions had to be applied for Berkeley and USL and AT&T. So there was a certain set of files for which the over, you know, was this, it was kind of splitting of the, you know, Solomon splitting of the baby, that some aspects had to be held in common. But you're right, there is a certain, you know, settlement that was made for correcting a BSD-based solution.
So I'm seeing that correction seemed to be going a lot more smoother than this one, and I'd like your opinion on what we can possibly learn from that historical event and what separates that from this.
Well, there wasn't a bunch of, was there a bunch of stockholders who were opening cash in?
Is that it? Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listening to Darrell's story at the beginning, it seems like it's a very interesting and compelling story. The guy shows up, there's a lot of money he sees laying on the ground, and he goes out and tries to do it. You know, God bless America. For us on the other side of this, it's the question of where's our, you know, what's our exposure and what do we have to do? And truly, what should we do from now on all the time when we make software? So this kind of thing never happens to us in a small, in a microcosm case.
I think this casts, as I said before, it creates a lot of doubt, and it probably it undermines the certainty that any given technology purchase that might have some kind of open source influence can be ever completely safe.
Yeah.
And I think it creates the impression in the industry that somebody is trying to patent the carbon atom, you know, something that is ubiquitous and permeates everything. Somebody went back and found out that they happened to own it, and now we're all liable, you know.
Interesting. Any questions? Yep. Amy?
I think it's interesting to note that while some of the members of this panel seem to think that that Linux developers or customers are avoiding making open source decisions because of the SCO activities, in fact, that is not borne out by what's going on in the marketplace. The Linux market share has increased during this period to the detriment of Unix, not to the detriment of Microsoft operating systems, which is simply a continuation of a very long-range trend, and that is in spite of the fact that we are paying more for Linux as time goes on. It's absolutely correct to note that it is not a free operating system. Most people choose to buy a paid version and to buy maintenance and support at the same time rather than buying simply getting the software for free. And also that there are more and more developers moving their applications to the Linux platform or developing first port, the first version for Linux and then porting off of Linux instead of porting to Linux after they finish the application development. So there's absolutely no indication at all, as far as I can tell, that that's going on. The numbers do not support it.
The same could be said for illegal music file sharing online. You know, until lawsuits started dropping like rain, it was undiminished, even when they were threatening them. But now that hundreds of people have been sued, I think there's some evidence that that is in decline. But on the other hand, that's also accompanied by reasonable legal alternatives to using the music, and that's what we need to see here, too.
The lawsuit in question here is the lawsuit against IBM, and kind of famously, they didn't pay you to go away. Or buy you, as everybody says. I mean, is IBM the wrong target for this? I really got 7,000 Linux developers, I read. I mean, as in terms of the people in the world, did you start with IBM because they had the deepest pockets and they were most likely to settle? I mean, why IBM first?
We filed suit against IBM because we had a significant problem in terms of a major contract violation that was very damaging to SCO.
Uh-huh.
And it was very obvious and apparent to us. A lot of the other issues in terms of, you know, IP issues that we've identified took a lot longer for us to be able to research and uncover. It's not, you know, in a way, you're talking about 7 million lines of code or more, and going through all of that is like looking for needles in a haystack in some cases.
Now, how do you prove this in a court of law? I mean, no offense, Steve, but when I talk to lawyers, doesn't seem to me that they've got these bigger pictures involved. And you guys have picked David Boies, who's one of the top lawyers in the world. But how do you go about convincing? Yeah, he lost his last case with Al Gore. How do you go about convincing and proving people who are not computer people who are not coders, that this exists? I wonder if this is a difficult or...
Two words,
yeah.
Expert witnesses.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And if they are believable,
interesting.
Then you know, the judge or jury is going to accept it from one or the other.
So you pay money for an expert to come in and say,
well,
I say this.
Complex,
and the other guys do the other
you know,
thing.
We have lay judges and lay juries.
Sure.
And you hit them with sufficiently complex cases.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to be pragmatic and cynical about it, I mean, those are the best to understand it, but at some point they start to have psychological reactions because they're human beings, and they believe somebody is feeding them a cleaner story than somebody else, and they end up going that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of what we're hearing is that it's going to be really, you know, a black and white situation. You put the code up there side by side. You don't have to be technical to know that it's the same. In the old days, in the copyright world, they were called things like mapmakers' tricks. No, mapmakers would salt their maps with false towns, railroad sidings that didn't exist, things of that sort, because it was an open and shut case when you found the copy. There was no way for those things to be there as artifacts unless there had been copying. And SCO presumably will be able to put the code side by side and say, there's just no reason that everything is going to line up this way if somebody did it innocently. It couldn't happen.
Again, I'd have to disagree with you, although I agree from the standpoint that expert witnesses is going to be what decides this. Putting the code side by side is helpful, but is it ironclad? No. Without the genealogy of that code along with it, it really doesn't tell the judges a whole heck of a lot. And a lot of this code that is absolutely identical has its heritage from BSD. We have seen that when we have done side-by-side code analysis. And, you know, I wish we had evidence to the difference. But
that's the same burden you have even, you know, in a music copyright.
Right.
You always have to separate the protectable from the unprotectable.
Right.
Right.
And I'll agree with Jeff that genealogy also has to be factored in, but not sure where he's looking at his genealogy, because some of what he's attributing to BSD is not appropriate, and even some of BSD has ended up in Linux without appropriate attribution, and all of that is a problem.
Interesting. Chris, what's the date of this lawsuit? When's this all going to come to a head or start
April
to come to a head?
2005. So
April 2005.
17 months out.
Maybe I'll actually watch Court TV and to start worrying about it then. Thank you very much. Please give me a big round of applause for our panel. Go forth and be open.
Very good. Thank you.
Kevin from The Lake Show. They just finished up the roundtable discussion, and we will be having our normal segment one with the panel as soon as everybody can regroup and call in. So go ahead, kick back, listen to some music, and we'll be back pretty quick. And we're back.
And it is segment number two of the Linux Show for November, the 18th, 2003, coming to you live from the keynote hall in the Jupiter Media Enterprise IT Week Expo. Interesting afternoon, that's for sure. We're going to start out the segment. Let me give you a few comments about the last couple of hours, what has transpired, and fill everybody in the IRC room about a number of the questions that I'm sure have been flying. But just preceding the town hall meeting was a keynote address by Darryl McBride. The keynote address, of course, was filled with a great deal of half-truths, if not outright lies.
We prefer to call it a key-not.
A key-not address.
Address.
I specifically chose not to broadcast the keynote address because I didn't think that there was going to be enough time in the town hall segment to address the things that Darryl talked about in his keynote. So that's why we skipped it. If people are really interested in hearing what Darryl had to say, it'll make your skin crawl. Go to the SCO website because they did hire a company to come in and pick up a file to stream the media off of their website later on this evening. So you can see Darryl's keynote address off of the SCO website later tonight. But the fundamental couple of key points that Darryl kept on stressing was the repeated claims of the theft of the SCO intellectual property. They continue to maintain that millions of lines of code have been obfuscated. They continue to maintain that the code has been outright copied, but they have escalated the overall dialogue a couple of degrees. Number one, part of the escalation is they're now referring to the Linux community in terms of analogies that reference us as bandits, outlaws, thieves, and thugs and skullduggery in general. Quite interesting, some of the analogies that were used today. I'm sure you heard one that was said by Chris Sontag in the town hall meeting about the reference to the Linux development community going in and robbing a bank and then throwing it back as still a damage to SCO. That's typical of the kind of rhetoric that has been coming out of Darryl and Chris all day long today. A little bit about the audience in general. The audience for the keynote address was surprisingly large, somewhere around 130. That may not sound like a lot, but the Enterprise IT Week Expo is a brand new expo. Brand new expos generally don't draw that many people. I think they've had an attendance for the entire week of under 1,000. And so to get 127 at a keynote is really doing pretty good. But give the devil his due, Darryl McBride. Number one, yesterday I was informed that Darryl had at the last minute decided not to participate in the town hall meeting. But in his stead would be Chris Sontag. And I should have questioned that when it happened. I wasn't really on my toes. I have to take total blame for this one. But at the very last minute, the last thing that Darryl said during his keynote address was to announce to the press corps that he was having an impromptu press conference during the town hall meeting. And so two-thirds, maybe even three-quarters of the press corps immediately stood up, walked out of the room, and went running down to the impromptu press conference, so they didn't have a chance to hear the information. Fortunately, I have been sitting with a number of the people in the media for the last 2 days in the press room, and I have been giving them a number of quotes, and including that quote you sent to me, Eric. Eric, you there?
Which one?
The one about OSI and the your code analysis.
Oh, yes, yes.
So I have been passing that out freely to the press the last couple of days, and it's probably going to start showing up in a number of articles very, very soon. Those people that did remain in the room, I would say for the majority of them, were fairly articulate in their knowledge of the situation and at best antagonistic to SCO. and which I suppose made it a little bit pleasanter for me. But it was definitely a balanced panel. Well, mostly balanced. There were two people on the SCO side. I was basically representing the open source side of the argument. And the guy from Jupyter Research really was doing his best to try and be neutral. His comments ended up coming out more in support of open source than not, but he really was trying to make an earnest attempt at being a fair researcher and trying to keep his arguments balanced. But you all heard the town hall meeting. You heard some of the comments. I will write some of the things up about which Darryl did say, and I'll post them out to Linux Today later tonight or tomorrow. But in the meantime, let's kick it on back to the whole panel and see if anybody's got anything to say about the town hall meeting. And, well, Eric, let's turn it over to you for starters. What did you think of the comments made by Chris Sontag?
It was pretty much the expected load of animal manure. It's the party line we've been hearing from FC all along. I didn't hear anything new.
Well, yeah, I other than, you know, still no proof, nothing new at all.
The usual ungrounded assertions about a million lines of code and lots of code they've supposedly shown when they've actually shown exactly two pieces, both of which have been immediately shot down and one of which isn't even in 2.6.
Yeah, well, Eric, can you address that in a little bit more detail?
Sure.
You did the analysis, or at least you participated in the analysis from Open Source Initiative. How thorough did you guys really check the kernel?
I wrote a tool called Comparator, which is a program for comparing large source code trees. You feed in any number of source code trees and let it run for a while, and it will find all of the common code segments in those trees. And I have run Comparator against System 5 Release 4, which is the immediate ancestor of the SCO Unixware code, and against Linux 2.4 and 2.6 and various other versions. And sure enough, the one piece of code they talked about at SCO Forum, which was the memory management allocation function, I found that code in 2.4.13, I think it was. But it's been gone for quite a while. It was removed from I think 2.4.19, not for copyright reasons. At that point, nobody knew that SCO was going to be making it an issue, but simply because it was ugly and the developers didn't like it. And in any case, if you look at that code, it turns out to be pretty tough call. I mean, I think it came from ancient Unix code that Caldera itself made open source a little more than a year ago. It's a tough call. It could have come from more recent System 5 sources, but even if it did, that would be an awful thin reed to hang $1 million intellectual property lawsuit on.
That's a $3 billion intellectual
$3 billion,
property.
Yeah. And the other piece of code that they've showed, they said, was firewall control code, which turned out to be Berkeley packet filter code, which was not only originally built by Berkeley, but the Linux implementation was a complete re-implementation that didn't even use the Berkeley sources. So they're basically pretty much completely out to lunch on both claims.
Okay, so how can you then how can you defend? Okay, I'm going to rephrase this. Let me back up. Part of the commentary of the lawyer who was sitting next to me, who was very pro-SCO, by the way.
Okay, I saw that. I heard it, rather.
Well, in the informal discussions before and after, he was obviously closely associated with SCO. So he was sort of a ringer on the panel. But anyways, he made a valid point about the need for there to be extremely competent.
No, he didn't.
Well,
no, he didn't. Actually,
he started to.
I know where he was going, and where he was going was not correct. There was a person at the panel who pointed out that the GPL is in fact a license, and if SCO has a problem with intellectual property of theirs supposedly being in Unix code, it's not the responsibility even of the distribution makers or even of Linus Torvalds to audit the code for its provenance. The responsibility for that belongs to the person who put the GPL on that code.
And with the transparency of the code,
right,
we should be able to identify that.
The story that Sko and their friends are trying to tell now is that everybody in the chain of transmission of Linux, from the developer through Linus Torvalds, the release manager, to the distribution makers, to the end users, they're trying to tell a story in which we are all jointly and severally responsible for any contamination at all in the code. But under the law, that isn't the case. When you put a license on a copyrighted work and you claim ownership of it, when you put that license on that work, that constitutes a representation, a warranty in effect, that you have the right to give away that code. And if somebody else has a problem with that code, it doesn't go to Linus Torvalds or to a distribution maker or to the developer community at large. It goes to the person who applied that license. That is the only person with a responsibility to do an intellectual property audit.
Fair enough. Jeff, Doc can't get in, so someone needs to call him on his cell phone.
So
Kevin will have to do that through the Webley.
Be very careful here, because there's a bunch of subtle traps in what SCO is doing, and one of the traps is the attempt to tie us down to an onerous, burdensome, and ultimately prohibitive audit process.
Exactly.
They would love that result. Or rather, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, who are paying them off, would love that result.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why I tried to mention peer review. And a number of the people in the audience were also shouting, peer review,
but,
as a
response.
But even
that is missing the point. It's not the peer's job to do that auditing. It's the job of the person who applied the license to the code when they sent it in.
Yes, but the peer review is there in place as a check and balance.
Yeah, but there's a difference between observing that peer review is useful for this and saying that the entire community is responsible for each and every violation. That's not the case.
Yep.
That's not the way the law works.
Yep. Couldn't argue with that at all. Well, let's go around the rest of the panel. Russ, I know you're called in. You listened to the segment. Have you got any comments?
Oh, God. The big thing is to keep my my tongue civil enough to make the comments. I'd like to actually address. I had the grave misfortune of actually watching the Donald McBride's keynote on.
So you saw all the free crap.
Oh, God, let me just address a few things because I'm sure people have missed it. You know, some of the really juicy points that that Darl put forward. He made several points about trying to dissuade or trying to get rid of what he considered to be misleading statements about SCO's position. And one thing he pointed out is that people say he's sue happy. He said that they've initiated exactly one lawsuit. That's all. They're not sue happy. Not 3 minutes later.
Yeah, exactly. This is funny.
Not 3 minutes later, he's talking about how he's going to sue every customer or potentially every customer who's using Linux, and that within 90 days, his lawyers will have the first one in court. And, you know, it's like, my golly, can you be more transparent than that? He also talked about, I understand the concept of free, because he's talking about free Linux and why it's, and then he goes on to talk about free as in free music, free internet service, free bandwidth, etc. And it's rather clear he has no idea.
He has no clue.
He has no idea about what free is, or at least he has an idea and he's doing his darndest to lie about it. But it was absolutely stunning that he could play that card, but he did.
Well, keep in mind about this that they've been here now for 2 days telling the story, and so the buzz about free and the buzz about Sue Happy and this whole line that he's been, that he gave in the presentation this afternoon. He's been giving this now for 2 days. And everybody in the press room is sitting around saying exactly what you just said, that he has no clue of what open source is. He has no clue at all. He doesn't get it. He's trying to use the analogy of Napster to label open source with when they couldn't be completely different in terms of exercises of a business development process. So this has not, my point is, this has not escaped the media.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. There were a few other claims, too. Let me just throw a few others out here that are just worth mentioning. One is he talked about how they've displayed, he went as far as to say that they identified these million lines of code and they went out without comment, without getting the feedback from the community about these million lines of code. I mean, there was a very strange statement to make, and beyond belief, quite frankly. He ignored entirely the business of Caldera's opening of the older forms of Unix. He came up with some strange numbers about how software is driving industries right now. Someone saying that it would be a $229 billion business by 2007. You know, my first question is, who the hell's making this money?
Microsoft.
Yeah, basically. Well, but even then, Microsoft ain't making $227 billion at this point.
Well, that's that. There was a group of people in the press room that were laughing this morning because they did a press conference this morning. The focus of the press conference was more dealing with the Du Bois multi-million-dollar leverage of handing off a substantial portion of the company to Du Bois. It pays to be a lawyer, I guess. But anyways, at the press conference this morning, they were discussing that subject, and the people in the media were, again, laughing at the comments that Darryl was making about the lack of response, and saying how can you ignore all of the media coverage that has been going on since March of this year on this subject to say that the story has gone unresponded to is laughable at this point. It's almost as if they're living in a fantasy world.
Yeah. Well, that was shown too when he did an economic analysis of, you know, what will happen if the GPL remains intact and open source,
yes,
et cetera.
God bless America, and SCO will save all of our jobs, right?
It was the most moronic economic analysis I've ever heard when it comes to the software industry. It was the most FUD-filled, intelligence-free discussion I think I've ever heard, because it basically took everything to the extreme, and he spent a lot of time setting up straw men and knocking them down, and he used Richard Stallman in that area, you know, quoting Stallman saying, you know, that there shouldn't be any closed source software anywhere, etc., you know, quoting Richard directly, but then basically saying that, you know, these people are out to destroy this $229 billion industry. And it was just, you know, just an amazing piece of work.
Yep.
An amazing piece of work.
Yeah, the interesting thing, one of the people from eWeek was talking this morning about how this argument of SCO about that $229 billion is, they're forgetting about how 10 years ago and 15 years ago, the majority of that asset was concentrated into the hardware companies. And at that time, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, a Microsoft license probably cost $69. Today, the computer is cheaper than it was 15 years ago, 10 years ago, incredibly more powerful, and yet the Microsoft license is twice as much money as it was back then and now comprises 60% of the total purchase cost of a PC today. So to claim that IP drives the computer industry is a little bit illusionary, without taking into consideration the fact that the impact that that has had on the hardware manufacturers.
Yeah.
So.
Well, also, just as another footnote on this great economic analysis, he basically said that the U.S. U.S. manufacturing has failed so miserably that the only way that the American economy is, can survive is through protection of intellectual property. Basically, we are so frickin' clueless as a nation that the only thing we have left to protect is our intellectual property. So we better darn well stomp out these free software people because they will ruin the one asset left to the country.
Yeah, the gloom and doom scenario was just like, I mean, he was really stretching it there.
Yeah, he conveniently fails to mention that that same community launched the Internet revolution 10 years ago, so, but that's just convenience. Well, Arnie, seeing as you chimed in, why don't you throw a few cents into the equation?
I did not hear the entire keynote address. However, I did catch the end of it, and there's a couple of things that I'd like to drop into the discussion. One is this crazy, insane claim that open source people do not believe in copyright. And, you know, this just shows the extent to which Darryl and his minions at SCO will go to try to twist and spin things their way. Of course, our position is very clear, and it always has been, and has been from the very beginning, that the whole free software environment depends solely on the copyright laws for its license. I mean, without copyright, we have nothing.
Well, yeah, it's my IP. It's not your IP.
Yeah,
That's the deal with SCO. It's they're concerned about my IP. They could give a damn about anybody else's IP.
Yeah, but the copyright, I mean, without copyright, GPL doesn't work.
That's,
you know, because every single shred of GPL code is copyrighted, every single shred of it.
Yeah. A couple of my extremely old friends and I hooked up together late last week. These were guys from my old Radio Shack days back in the late 70s. And we were talking about this issue, about licensing. And we were trying to, you know, think about the small computer business and when licensing really started to come into play. Because in the beginning, there were no licenses. Everything was about copyright. Nothing was about license. And most of us back then who were writing software, in the late 70s, you were paid by X manufacturer or an independent company that needed product to develop, and you owned the copyright of the code that you developed for them, and you went on your merry way to try and make more money off of that said software if you could. But there just wasn't license protections. In fact, an awful lot of what we wrote back then was in languages like BASIC and Pascal, that the source was basically open. There was no way to protect it except through the copyright. But if people took it, modified it, and came up with new applications, there was very little you could do.
And it, and from that type of thing came the very, very famous Bill Gates letter.
Right.
And which was published in all the hobbyist magazines, including
1984.
Dr. Dobbs' Journal of Computer Calisthenics and Orthodontia, Running Light without Overbite, which was the predecessor of Dr. Dobbs' Journal. And I somewhere in my archives, I have those first three or four issues, including that letter.
Yeah, so my point here in saying all this is the entire industry was founded without licenses. Okay?
That's right.
So to say that it couldn't continue to exist on that same level is a ridiculous assumption and just arrogance on the part of SCO.
I'm going to surprise everybody.
Go ahead.
Pardon? I'm going to surprise everybody. This is my economist head speaking. No, that in itself is actually not a bad argument. Because one of the things we do see over and over again in developing technology industries of all kinds is people initially, during the initial exuberant exploratory phase, being fairly careless about who owns what. But as soon as a technology starts to be monetized in any way, everybody gets a lot more careful. So, I mean, that's claiming that a mature software industry doesn't need stringent licensing just because it didn't have it back at the beginning is actually not a good argument. SCO is on good, is on solid ground there. Don't use that argument or they'll beat you.
No, Eric, I think you're misreading me. I'm not saying that licenses aren't a good thing. Okay, I'm just saying that the industry was started that way and it worked
right.
in the early days.
No, and that tells you nothing about current circumstances. And if you try to use that argument, they'll beat you.
Well, perhaps yes.
I think Jeff was just trying to counteract Daryl's claims about IP and licensing and copyright.
Right. I agree that in general those claims are spurious, but you need to be careful about what arguments you use to refute them. And the origins argument that Jeff just made is one that's going to get your head handed to you.
Well, he's not making it in a court of law. Thank goodness.
So, Arnie, any more comments?
No, I mean, I didn't hear a lot of it because I got in from school late, but I did get up MTurk player and listen to the last part of Daryl's thing, and you know, I'm just like Russ, I was shocked at the number of the amount of dissembling, you know, and just total outright outlandish claims that just it couldn't hold water. I mean, I couldn't write them down fast enough. There were so many of them.
Okay, here's the good news. Okay, and then we'll go on to the next person at the table. The good news is, this whole conference has been about open. Okay, SCO's the only person here. Oh, I should clarify that. Microsoft did one presentation at the conference about XML. But other than that one presentation by Microsoft, this conference has been all about open. Open standards, open technologies, open software. And so the vibe here is exceedingly pro-open. And so to say that the majority of the attendees were looking upon the commentary of SCO with any sense of validity, it just wasn't there. In fact, I'm sure you heard one of the people in the audience who was a researcher stated that 85% of some polled population, I don't know where her statistic came from, I'll have to see if I can find her in the hallway, but 85% of IT enterprise IT managers could care less about this lawsuit. They think it's irrelevant. But that, I thought, was a very interesting observation. So is Doc in yet?
I'm here.
Doc.
I'm here, yeah.
Were you able to?
Yeah, I got in during the town meeting and decided that it would be better not to waste the battery and just listen to it on the laptop, which I did. But then when I tried to get back in again, the voice filter guy just wouldn't let me in. So anyway, so Kevin or somebody called me and it worked out. So the question I've got, because I didn't catch all of it, I tried to catch as much of it as I could. Was the moderator on that Jack Powers? Is that right?
That was Jack Powers, yes.
Yeah. It sounded like he was kind of friendly. Was that correct?
Okay. What he was trying to prevent was Chris Sontag from exploding.
Really?
Yeah. You don't, until you've seen Chris Sontag and I in the same room together, you just don't understand the level of tension that is imagined by this man. He
shouldn't let it happen.
He is of the impression that I am going to attack Daryl. I mean, physically. Physically. When I walked down the hallway and they saw me walking down the hallway, their security guy came charging out and demanded to see the security chief of the building. Because they wanted extra security added.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting.
The same thing happened at SCO Forum. They had SCO people follow me around the entire time I was there because they were afraid I was going to throw a pie at Daryl.
Oh, gee.
That is bizarre.
No, just an intellectual pie.
But I don't know where this rumor came from. It's been floating around now for 2 years that I'm going to get Daryl, you know? And I don't know where it came from, but that's been the thing. And so Sontag hates me. I mean, he hates me with a passion. There have been press conferences where I've asked a question, and he stood up and started screaming at me.
Wow.
And I thought
Amy Wohl in the audience was great.
Yeah,
that was Amy Wohl. Interesting.
That was Amy Wohl, your neighbor. Your neighbor. Yeah.
She's the one who...
With that Eastern Pennsylvania accent, it's kind of hard to miss.
She's the one who had the statistic of the 75 or 85% of IT managers.
Right.
Okay. So.
Yeah, she's the one who said, listen, I'm talking to these people, and, you know, they're not with you on this. Yeah, I thought it was really good to have her there to kind of call bullshit on things.
Yeah, it was good to have a bullshit meter in the audience. There was actually a couple of people in the audience who were raspberrying. You couldn't hear them, but they were making appropriately rude noises during the town meeting.
Was this at the Mandalay Bay?
Yeah, I was on the same stage where Daryl gave his keynote about 5 minutes after the keynote.
Yeah. I'm sorry I couldn't make it over because I'm about a mile away, but I'm at ApacheCon where I'm giving a keynote tomorrow, and I was tied up with some other stuff today. There's just no way I can do it.
Yeah. Well, apparently a lot more interesting things are happening at ApacheCon than are happening here. At least on the, SCO is not an interesting subject anymore to me, but it's an illuminating subject. But what did you see at ApacheCon today?
Well, the interesting thing to me about ApacheCon is that, if you look at the latest Netcraft figures, Apache's at like 68% now of all web servers that they can see in the world, and these guys are, you know, they achieved world domination so long ago. It's not even like something they care about. It's just impressive, you know. It's a bunch of geeks all. It's more chaotic and yet somehow, you know, very organic. It's an interesting bunch of people to hang around. A lot of talk about RSS, which impressed me. I didn't realize RSS was going to be that big a part of the conversation. Chris Perillo gave a talk today about the death of email and the role that RSS is going to play in whatever it is that's going to succeed marketing as a way to get one's message out to the world, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah, if you want to find out about RSS, just go to Chris Perillo's new website. LockerGnome.com has been changed. It's now an RSS delivery mechanism.
Well, the big surprise with Chris is that I hadn't seen Chris in a few months, and he shows up, and he introduces his girlfriend. Well, the last I saw, he was married, Eric. You know, it's like, whoa, wait a second. Wow, okay. And he then explains that he's now living in Woodland Hills, which is down near where I live. You know, I mean, he's now in the valley. He's like in Los Angeles. And his girlfriend's from L.A., and he's completely changed Locker Gnome, and he's completely changed everything else. He just said he took his life and turned it upside down, but he's still the same hyper-enthusiastic speaker.
Way too enthusiastic.
It was very, very much outside the mold of, you know, of your bearded, t-shirted, sandal wearing kind of shuffling around. You know, geeks is kind of you know, like having a large rodent in a brace of walruses.
Well, the whole Apache story has been part of the dialogue going on here about SCO. The fact that Apache really started making inroads into the Solaris market as early as 95 and has been steadily, you know, chipping away without the Solaris source code. So the point that I'm making is Linux succeeded as an open source developed product without the knowledge of the Solaris source code. Without even the claimed inclusion of System 5, because in those early days, there was no claimed remnant. But it's part of the picture that a lot of the media is really surprising me this week. The media are really asking questions like, well, how can you explain that Apache has succeeded? How can you explain that Linux has been, you know, eating away at HPUX, has been eating away at BSD? How can you explain that?
How can you also explain why Novell is willing to pay $250 million for a Linux distributor and a Linux desktop company if they don't see a business opportunity there? You know, it's like, I mean, the whole skill model is, you know, you can only make money on those things that you can, that you can claim intellectual property on. It's an insane idea as an exclusive idea. It's certainly a way to make money. It's not the only fucking way to make money. But the interesting thing to me, just getting away from SCO for a second, about ApacheCon is that here's Sun and Novell and Apple all there as Unix companies. You know, that's the story that they're telling. That's what they're, you know, feeding to the geeks, and the geeks are taking it. You know, it's a pretty interesting thing. Novell gave what had to be the dullest presentation I've ever seen in my life today, but they were saying the right, I don't know, the right thing. You know, for that, they just weren't very charismatic. I mean, I think if they'd had Miguel there or Matt, it would have been a whole different story. But those guys are off somewhere else. You know, I mean, the last time
there would have been
gaps
in the ceiling.
They were saying things like, "Boy, you know, those young guys, Zimmy and Boy, they are really good." but they couldn't really say much more. They gave a whole presentation about Mono, and I just kept wanting to have Miguel there to, you know, be as enthusiastic in his own way as Chris Perillo was earlier. You know.
Yeah. Well, enthusiastic
personality.
Enthusiasm is hard.
It's almost hard if you don't have it, you know, and it's just not your personality. If you have a bunch of introverts and that, you know, aren't, you know, that's just the way they are. But at least that particular three people that they brought up on stage were. With Apple, I mean, at least I would say half, maybe three quarters of the laptops are OS X Macs at ApacheCon. And that was, you know, and that's because you can open the command line and do all kinds of Unix shit on it because it's got BSD under there.
Can I ask you two questions about ApacheCon?
Sure.
Okay, and I'll ask you both questions and then you can answer both. Question number one is, Sun is very present there at ApacheCon. They're not present here at all. They're not present at Comdex at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very much a Apache / open source / Linux company this week. Is there any schizophrenia being evident at Sun at the expo itself? That's question number one. Because there's been a lot of talk here at this expo about Sun's schizophrenia over the last few weeks. The second question is there any buzz on JBoss on the floor of the expo at ApacheCon?
I'll answer that one first. I haven't heard anything about JBoss. In fact, I was going to ask the Sun people about JBoss. I had a little conversation with three of them. Denise Cooper, who's an old friend and who's been involved in the open source side of that for a long time, and John Foreman, who gave a talk yesterday, and Simon Phipps, who works at Sun but runs the Liberty Alliance thing, who I saw at the Digital ID World a few weeks ago, and is also a good guy. And all three of them disclaimed, they said, you know, the problem with Scott is that he's extremely quotable even when he says the wrong things.
Yeah.
And he said, for example, he said, we don't have a Linux strategy, we have a Unix strategy, and all he got quoted on was the first half of that. That he had it backwards. You know, they can't say they have exclusively a Linux strategy, and if they're still busy selling Solaris. And the way that they talked about it is like, okay, you know, we've got our Solaris market. It's mature. It's what it's been. We're not giving up on this. We have a lot of customers that use these big iron things that we do, and that's, we're going to continue serving them the way that we have, and that is not inconsistent with having a Unix, I mean, a Linux strategy that, and they're very, it's interesting because there, Denise especially stressed what they were doing in China, where they, I mean, they have a deal with the Chinese government to sell as many as 500,000, or no, I'm sorry, not 500,000, 500 million of these little, little white boxes. I forget the name of the, what was the code name of the, Mad Hatter? Is it Mad Hatter?
500 million?
The low-end laptop, the low-end desktop that they announced a year ago.
Did I hear you say 500 million?
500 million.
Jesus H. Christ and the Gautama Buddha on a tandem bicycle.
I know. With it, and of course, that's, you know, like over the next 10 years. But, you know, but
that's huge.
They say that the Chinese government is very serious about not being on Microsoft, and they want to deal with a company or several companies. Of course, they'll make the things in China. That's very important, right? And but they said that's, you know, they have a very big third world Linux strategy that involves selling as many as possible, as cheap as possible boxes to the largest possible number of people. They said that they have the lowest of the low end strategies that are out there right now, and it's very un-Sun of them to be doing that, but that's what their strategy is in that part of the world, and they've been working that one for a long time. The other thing is that they endorsed Opteron for their Linux boxes and not Intel, and so they were sort of proud on that thing too.
So I save money that way too.
It's a non-alpha box.
If I'm going to buy 500 million machines, I'm going to look not going to probably buy Pentium 4s.
I suppose. In any case, there, you know, that
I don't think it would matter.
You know, the problem with these big companies is that there's no they. As a matter of fact, I think it was Simon who said that. He said, you know, he's worked at a number of large companies, and there never is a they. There's, you know, I know there's a big hunk of IBM that sells desktops and laptops especially that's still very much in bed with Microsoft, and there's another much larger hunk of the company that's very much all about Linux, and those are not, that's not schizophrenic, that's just business. That's, you know, they're a big company and they have many divisions and they do business a number of different ways.
Yeah, but IBM makes that totally clear.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
And Scott McNeely never makes it totally clear.
Yeah, oh, no, I have to own that. They said IBM has just done an incredibly good job of getting completely in front of the bandwagon and having a really clear message and going out of their way to do that. But at the same time, I had another conversation for somebody else, for a relatively low-level rank-and-file guy who's doing Apache stuff for Sun, who asked me, like, I know, but I don't know, I had some insights on this because I've worked with Sun before. Why is it that Sun has just never, ever been able to do really good PR or really good marketing? You know, marketing. No, they just have never been able to, I mean, or advertising, rather. They've just never been able to do it. And that's endemic for a lot of tech companies. And IBM has always gone high end advertising.
Yeah. Who put
the dot in dot com?
Who was that?
I don't remember who was that. Wayne Rosings, maybe? I don't know. Somebody. But it was a silly idea.
Yeah.
And it didn't mean anything. Yeah, it's like, you know, who put the dot in dot com? We did, you know, so we're going to go down with the rest of this craze. That was sad. But they've never been able to do it. And I think the reason is that they've never been able to trust either their own best people or their own best outside agencies. And I know that because I've worked with them before.
Yeah.
It's just they are, in fact, and this is not a bad thing. It's probably a good thing. They are a bunch of engineers. And,
yep.
You know, and bunches of engineers are not very trusting of marketers, period. And legitimately, you know, and it takes IBM is advantaged in this respect because they've been a consumer marketing company as well as a big manufacturing and a big service company for a very long time. And so they can do that. I mean, it's not a problem. Somebody up high says, you're going to use this agency and you're going to use these creative people. You know, and they hired Steve Hayden to do stuff. I mean, Steve Hayden, who at Chaya Day did the Apple 1984 ads, and like all the great advertising Apple did in the 80s and early 90s with Steve Hayden's. And he went over to another agency, BBDNO, I guess it was, and IBM used him, you know, and that stuff filters down, even if it's a goofy campaign like the, you know, the whatever it was, Sex, Love, and Linux, you know, where they're painting stencils on public sidewalks and shit. I mean, that was, you know, that came out of a willingness on the high up in that company to do aggressive things in the marketing sphere, and nobody else does that. And so, you know, relatively speaking, Sun is going to look kind of lame and goofy unless it's Scott talking. And they kind of live and die by Scott talking, you know.
And that turns the company into a cult of personality, and it's not doing them any favors.
It's really not. It's really not. And as quotable and as smart as Scott is, one can't, you know, I mean, like a number of other CEOs, but what's his name from Novell, the founder of the company, who was Captain Ahab going after Microsoft, you know, I mean, and there's something about Scott that's similar. He's got Microsoft all over the burner, you know, and it's the great white world, and it doesn't help. It really doesn't help, because there are other ways to win without beating that guy. But, you know, he comes across that way. I mean, he even plays off it himself, and he gives a speech. He says, I have to work in some kind of mock of Microsoft somewhere in here. Well,
yeah.
That's fine, and it's pro forma at this point, but it doesn't really help. But, you know, it's his company. He gets to do what he wants.
That's right.
The people down below are just kind of cringing and working with it.
Let me jump in here on the J-Boss thing, as you don't know about it. Maybe if I make a comment or two, you might have heard something walking down the aisleway.
Well, I can ask tomorrow. Business movie. Yeah.
But, no, the J-Boss, there's been the last week comments floating around that there is J-Boss source code that is showing up in the Apache Geronimo. And a number of people from J-Boss have been sort of very apologetic. They even mentioned it the week before ApacheCon, that they said even if it is true, they should have kept their mouths shut and not rocked the boat the week before the conference. But I was just wondering if those kind of comments out of JBoss have sort of calmed the waters and there is no upset on the floor of the expo.
Well, again, I'll listen tomorrow, but I've heard nothing so far.
Yep.
I've heard
okay.
nothing. And mostly, Sun hasn't been especially, you know, creating the Java project's 5th anniversary or something like that. They get another live stream social tonight, something like that. But I just haven't heard anything yet. So
what party are you going to tonight, Doc?
I'm going to none because this is the party. This is my party. I got a couple slices of pizza that I brought down here, and that's the end of it. Because I've got a keynote tomorrow, and I've got a big piece due for Linux Journal too. So I can't party tonight, or even go out and try and look at the meteor shower.
Well, I was going to do that, and then go to bed early because I got a 4 a.m. Hookup with a limo. So I'm getting out of here early tomorrow morning. So,
yeah, I'll see you even tomorrow. Okay.
Kevin, have you got
anything? Any parties tonight? Or no, you're gonna late. You're gonna crash out. Okay.
Yep. Kevin, have you got anything you want to throw in here?
Not really. I mean, everybody's from SCO seems to be blowing pretty hard. We'll see what happens when they actually have to give testimony in court.
Well, that's what it boils down to. It is now quite apparent that you know, SCO is ready to dig in for the 17 months and see if they can survive that long. And they're not going to talk before then. It's quite obvious that they're just not opening their mouths. And so it's going to be a mystery for another 17 months plus the time it takes in court. But
unless they pull off, and we have two news releases just hit the wire within the last few moments. One is on from TechFocus, and one is the Wall Street Journal, and they're both reporting that SCO is going to sue a significant user of Linux, and this is something coming right out of Daryl and Sontag's mouth within minutes of the end of the town meeting.
Yep, so you can expect to see SCO's stock go up tomorrow.
Well, it didn't. At the closing, it was taking a dive, a little bit of a dive, not much, but it did gain a couple tenths today. But that was after some early gains, and then it's down at the end there.
Well,
so we'll see what happens.
Real quick, and seeing as you're talking, Ernie, I'd like to start with you. Let's just go around the table one more time. Everybody, throw out a final comment. And we'll call it an evening. So, Ernie, your last comment of the evening.
Well, I mean, you know, this whole school thing is, you know, like we try to avoid it on a weekly basis. Sometimes it raises its ugly head. I am just getting really impatient with the court, and I know the court takes its time, but someone's going to act on this because SCO is just. You know, they're just telling lies, and you're not allowed to lie about things, I don't think, when you file a court case. You're not allowed to tell a bunch of lies and try it in public. I mean, the judge has got to be cringing.
You're wrong, Arnie. You can lie in public. You just can't lie before the judge.
Yeah, well, I mean, but if they're presenting cases like their case based, if they're presenting anything on the same information in court that they're presenting in public, I mean, they're going to be laughed out of court.
Well, yeah, the because I say so defense does not stand up in court.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, this is like, you know, like wholly without merit.
So, Russ.
That's my comment.
Okay,
I mean,
Russ.
This is ridiculous.
Russ, you got a comment?
Yeah, just that, you know, this is a story that won't go away, although we may all hope it. Also, by the way, I don't know whether anyone mentioned it, but I see on the wire that apparently SCO is now saying that Novell is breaking its contract by acquiring SUSE. And the logic there is that since it believes SUSE Linux is a derivative of System 5, this violates the non-compete clause that SCO and Novell entered into back in 1995.
But he's not so happy.
He's not sue happy, no, because so far he's only sued one person. He's just threatened to sue millions.
I think we ought to dedicate a song to Mr. Gerald McBride, and that's Johnny Cash is a boy named Sue.
That works.
That's funny. Let's write up a parody on that one, that's for sure.
Everybody here has seen...
We need a flash animation of that one.
Yeah, everybody here has seen the Grinch parody of Let's Go?
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
that's very
great.
Funny. That's very funny. Eric, have you got a final comment?
Just, I didn't hear anything new today. The remarkable thing was that the dog did not bark in the night.
Yeah, it just whimpered.
Yeah.
And Doc?
Yeah, I although it's interesting, and by the way, I thought you did... a pretty good job considering it sounded like you're in a fishbowl of sharks at that place. I just hate giving any airtime to those guys. I mean, I've never seen anything like this where a company, they're not just suing another company, you know, or when they do sue another company, they go and talk to the press like every other day. They've got a press conference about something. It's just really, really weird. And I mean, the feeling that I have is that these guys are playing a really dangerous game that they're going to lose in the long run, and they're going to lose bad. But I don't know. In the meantime,
they have all that money coming in from Microsoft, so they don't care.
Yeah. Well. And that needs to be exposed to. I've heard it both ways about that. I mean,
you think those guys aren't going to bail out with golden parachutes if the company goes down? You watch.
Well, I certainly think they will.
Half of them are going to end up with jobs.
The question I have is whether or not they're going to be, you know, standing there with Frank Quattrone in a few years. You know,
that's right.
I mean, that's what I think. I mean, these guys, these guys are playing a stock game. You know, they don't have any other game to play. And they're doing it by spreading, spreading fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the marketplace. And I don't know exactly what the laws are on that, but it strikes me that that ought to be illegal. And if it's not actually, I just feel like they're lying, and they know they're lying. And I'm just astonished that they successfully sound as sincere as they do.
Well, you weren't listening apparently, because I did directly ask Chris Sontag. You know, Eric gave me information on the OSI analysis. I know how he did it. I know that he did it. I trust his conclusion. And, the because-I-say-so argument doesn't work. Give me some evidence or let me talk to somebody who did the analysis. And this time there was no mysterious crew of geniuses from MIT that they called on.
Of course, that's been debunked in the press anyway.
Yep. Yeah, well, they have no, they just say the code's there, but they no longer make a claim of how they've determined it. There is no basis of fact now. So, but my closing comment for the night, and then we'll just go ahead and sign off till next week, but I want to put it to everybody this way. For the first time in this already way too long issue, for the first time a week ago, IBM made a very, very public comment about the case. Up until a week ago, IBM has been saying no comment. They have answered specific questions with talk to our lawyers, and the lawyers say no comment. And this is the way big companies do things. This is the way adults who hire competent lawyers do things, is you don't argue your court case in the public. You argue it in the courtroom where it belongs. However, something has changed. A week ago, IBM came out publicly and made a whole series of press releases about some documents that they were filing involved with the court case, specifically that they were asking the judge to force SCO to present some form of documentation to prove that they even have a reasonable possibility of proving their claim, or to set aside the case immediately, just a summary judgment. And, of course, there has not yet been a ruling on this, but this is a departure of what has been going on.
I can tell you a bit about this.
Well, you can follow me up, Eric.
Okay.
But I know a little bit about the mentality of large business lawsuits, because I've been involved with so many of them over my lifetime. And companies like IBM never say anything like this. They never ask for evidence or a summary judgment unless they are 100% positive they're going to win. Because basically what they want to do is escalate the case into court so they can get the damn thing out of their hair.
Hmm.
So, Eric?
I think they need to bring it to the court quickly.
The amended discovery request that IBM filed includes a demand for machine-readable source code. That's my understanding. And that's a key issue because apparently one of the stonewalling things that SCO did was, yeah, sure, have source code, printouts.
Yeah, that's like paying, like someone compared that to like paying your income taxes with pennies.
Oh, well, no, that's a different case. I'm in favor of anybody who screws up the IRS.
but that's still the same thing.
So one of their demands is machine-readable source code.
Yep. But still, the very specific point that IBM was making last week was that this case has now been filed since the beginning of March, and as of yet, in all of SCO's filings, they have only asserted claims. They have not offered a single scrap of evidence Now, they have said, well, you can sign an NDA, but then that information is not admissible to court because then they've got a contract that prevents somebody from testifying in court. This is a very, very sound strategy on the point of IBM, and I certainly hope it's successful in escalating this thing into courts as quickly as possible. I would prefer not waiting 17 months.
Actually, this could be pushed to a conclusion as soon as December 5th. There are two hearings on discovery coming up, one on November 21st and one on December 5th. And the way the court, the docket schedule works, on December 5th, if the judge is has a belief that SCO has not rendered evidence and is not going to render evidence, at that point the judge could quash the lawsuit.
That means swat it like a deader than a Purdue chicken.
That's right.
Well,
so it appears from the filings that might be what IBM is playing for.
Well, if the analysis by OSI and others is as accurate as I have been told, okay, let's be real people. IBM is a multi-billion dollar company. Certainly, they've pulled apart that source code nine ways to Sunday, and they know the genealogy of every damn line of that code by now. And so they wouldn't be escalating this quickly if they didn't have solid evidence in their support. So that's just my opinion, of course, and I am not a lawyer. So don't go buying any stock based upon my recommendations. So on behalf of the whole crew here tonight, it's been an interesting evening. Make sure you come back and check us out next week on Tuesday night. We'll be back with another edition of the Linux Show. Hopefully we'll be talking about more normal subjects for a change, and we'll put SCO off of the agenda, we hope, at least for next week's show. Until then, on behalf of the whole crew here, we're out of here. Thanks for joining us. Good night, everybody.
If he is the sun and she is the sea and she bleeds, from every dawn to every dusk of every day. If she is the boat and he is the breath that fills the gale, the crest and fall and thrust and thrall the bill on the sail. If he is the sextant, she is the stars by which he guides, from sombering sea to port at every even tide. If she is the gull and he is the sanguine song she cries, a wistful, wordless question posed to sea and sky. If he is the halcyon calm and she's a summer storm that drowns him in her furious skin and hungry wild and warm. catching breath, they enter the waves. For only the drowned can be saved. The weight of their trust shall carry them swift. So deep below the ebb and flow.